Steven, how long did it take you to get back from Seattle?
Everybody seems to know about this. It took me a long time. The door-to-door, I didn't even calculate what. I guess it would be 18 hours maybe, something like that. Close to that. Left my Seattle. Well, you got time zone conversions. I really don't know, Jack, actually. It was a long time. I left my hotel at 10 o'clock Pacific time, and I finally got home in Lansing at like 5:15 a.m. Monday morning. So somebody can figure that out for me real quick. Yeah, it was a trek.
Rob, remember when I said I was going to go on this trip, but I couldn't chance it as far as getting back for press pass?
I do.
I think we now know we have Exhibit A in the evidence bank for that. Speaking of banking, did you have any sleep banking, and did that come in handy?
No, I've been doing the opposite. I've been trying to catch up, from that debacle on my way home. Surprisingly, I'm more alive this week than I would have guessed. I thought right about now, actually Wednesday, Monday I just sort of powered through and it was what it was. But I thought Tuesday, Wednesday, at some point my battery's gonna die and I'm gonna become a zombie and really puke out there. But it hasn't happened yet. So, but that's kind of what I've been doing is just catching up on the back end. No, I did not do anything going out there.
No chance, knowing the kind of fighter you are, that 3:30 Friday, your battery's going to be on zero, right?
Typically, maybe. We'll have to see. 3:30 Friday, I'll probably be out getting ready to
3:30
watch.
Saturday would be worse, right?
Yeah, exactly. That would be a problem. Definitely get, all systems got to be go for that one. So that's, you slow, you peak, you fall down the hill, then you get back up and ramp back up for game day, I guess, is what I'm going to try to attempt here.
What did Michigan State do well, other than Keon Coleman's coming out party Saturday afternoon? A couple of goal line stands, I guess.
Yep, there was that.
Not many. It's a
Bryce
short list.
Berringer, I think, had two nice punts.
Yeah.
Had some other things going on with the kicks and everything, but two nice punts.
Yeah.
I thought Daniel Barker showed up a couple times and kept playing. Really, three guys I thought that just kept,
Yeah.
I hate to say it, but they sort of embodied the keep chopping, mindset and everything. It was Keon Coleman, who you mentioned, Daniel Barker, and Peyton Thorne. I thought Peyton Thorne, for the most part, played like a warrior out there and really showed his toughness and his grittiness, and I think that's positive. All in all, he really had a solid bounce back compared to those first 2 weeks, and that just went unnoticed because of how quickly things unraveled and how bad some other things were going. But that's about it, probably, in terms of the whole list, though, is those three guys.
Steven, what surprised you more, what Michael Penix Jr. was able to do in his best of three very good games against Michigan State? In those three games, by the way, he has thrown for 1,003 yards and 10 touchdowns. And he had 11 completions of more than 15 yards. Or the stunning inability of Michigan State to run the ball, other than Peyton Thorne on a couple of plays. But the average contact with the ball carrier was negative 0.5 yards, meaning a half yard into the backfield, there was initial contact from the Washington defense. And this was a ground game that had averaged over 6 yards a carry against nobody and had not had a negative yardage carry. That came to an end very quickly with Jarek Broussard in the safety.
Yeah, so. It was the run game for sure. I will just say on Michael Penix, I believe he has another year left. He might play himself into the NFL this year, probably, I would think, and especially given his injury history, he probably should. But knowing he's going to come to East Lansing next year and get one more crack at this team, I wonder if maybe that'll give him pause and say, ooh, I kind of want to do that again. When you say 1,000 yards in three games, my gosh.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
No, it was the second part that was more surprising because, look, I knew that, we all knew that the passing defense had some holes in it and hadn't really been tested. And this was their first test, and they failed in a big way. But and we knew Penix was good. So less surprising there. The run game, man, that was abysmal. Like you said, they're getting their average carrier or whatever carrier was getting touched in the backfield, not even getting to the line of scrimmage. And it looked like that. Every, whatever stat, whatever you want to say, it looked just as bad, like in real time. There's no putting any spin or lipstick on this one. Those guys just got just hammered up front. And, you know, the discouraging part is Washington, I don't think, you know, maybe I'll be proven wrong, but I don't think that's four or five All-Americans they have up front there. Right. You know, that's a team that was 98, I think, nationally last year against the run. And, look, they have a new scheme, new coaching staff, new coordinator, you know. I mean, you know, their offense didn't look like that last year, so I give them some credit. But it's got to be some of those same guys that ranked 98th nationally last year. You know, Portland State of FCS hasn't had a winning record since 2015, went in there a week prior and doubled up Michigan State's rushing total, ran for, I think, 81 yards, you know, on them. So that was the most concerning. I didn't think Michigan State would run for 200 and just mow them into the ground, but a respectable number to keep them in the game. You know, 80-something, kind of like Portland State did, is about what I expected. Because as you know, your listeners know, I've had reservations about this O-line all year, and now you guys know why. That we just saw. That was, they're not going to be anybody of substance with a performance like that.
When I asked people, Stephen, how many rushing yards Michigan State would have last week, the answer was just over 100 for most people. And some people had it a little under, but most people had it between 100 and, say, 125. And Jalen Berger was pretty pedestrian, less than 2 yards a carry. Didn't have any egregious plays, but certainly didn't do anything positive. Jerick Broussard had one of the worst days I've ever seen for a running back. And I'm not just talking about slipping when Matt Carrick was shoved backward towards him. I'm talking about going the wrong way on a handoff, went the opposite direction. On his first carry, I think he had a big hole, could have had a long gain, and he missed the read. And then dropping a two-point conversion pass that you could have caught. This is probably the worst day that we will ever see or have seen from Jerick Broussard. And I said at the time, when I saw him in the backfield, I have to tell you, the ball's on the one-yard line or inside the one. I said, man. I'd like to see Elijah Collins in the game here. And I think Elijah would have got two if there were two there, or at least would have got back to the line of scrimmage. And I'm not saying that that cost Michigan State the game, but the offense was only on the field for about 3 minutes in the first quarter.
Yeah. Broussard had an odd day out there, almost, you know, to the point that, like, it makes me wonder, you know, and I don't know anything, I'm not inferring anything, but he had one of those games where it makes you think, like, something might be going on in his personal life almost, or, like, you know, his dog ran away or something like that, you know, where he's thinking about stuff off the field, because he just clearly wasn't in the game, you know, mentally. Right. He got hit really hard on one of those kick returns, too. Yes. You mentioned the wrong way, the 2-point pass that was right there. Nobody with, you know, he had a very comfortable cushion of nobody even around him, just completely smoked that one. So yeah, and I turned to the people in the press box, which was really chilly, by the way, up there. It was open air. Nobody warned us about that. But turn to the other MSU writers, and I said, hey, if this game gets close enough to be winnable or losable, you know, and it wasn't at that point, but I was like, he's going to do something to lose this game. He's not in the right frame of mind right now. They sort of, you know, throttled him back a little bit as the game went on. I didn't think Jalen Berger looked bad necessarily. I thought he did what he could. I mean, he just had no help. There was nothing he was going to be able to. You could have had Adrian Peterson in his prime back there. Well, he might have got one or two, you know, but that's about it. They were getting no help up front consistently, and that was the most surprising for sure, because, I mean, I didn't think Washington was supposed to be this world beater. I don't think they have a bunch of pros on that D-line, maybe, I guess, but yeah, that was troubling, and it wasn't, you know, it didn't matter who they had back there. They weren't going to be able to do much with what they were doing up front. So it was a sort of a systematic thing, and that's what you said. They're not on the field. The defense is out there, you know, trying to catch their breath. And then, you know, Mel Tucker talks about complimentary football all the time. There's no better evidence of that not working, you know, and why it is so important than that sequence that you talked about, where you go goal line stand, next snap safety, next play, ball goes out of bounds, Washington's on the 50-yard line, and then they go right down and score another touchdown. Like, those three plays were the epitome of when complementary football does not work.
Yeah, and I thought that instead of all three units helping each other, it's almost like all three phases of the play hurt the other aspects of the game. you know, as you get the free kick out of bounds, and just so many things happened for Michigan State. But I'm wondering about this defense, pass defense, and when Mel Tucker talks about personnel changes, what does he mean? Who do you think we're going to see that we didn't see Saturday?
I think the only one I'm feeling fairly confident on right now would just be rolling with what they did mid-game when they swapped out Chester Kimbrough for Justin White at nickel. It was obvious, you know, that they were targeting Kimbrough. It was like wherever he's lined up, that's where we're going to go with the ball. That's our best matchup over and over again. And so they made that change. You know, and that's not to, you know, Kimbrough, Mel talked about that after the game, as Washington found a matchup they liked and they kept going to it. And that's true, but he wasn't the only one, you know, that was messing up back there. I don't think any of the DBs can say they had a good day. I mean, Gross was out of position. Both of the corners were giving up passes. It was pretty much a bad day across the board. So I don't think anybody comes out of that feeling good. But right now, I think, they stick with Justin White probably at nickel. I just don't think you can go back to Kimbrough right now. Maybe, you know, later get his confidence back, get confidence in him back, you know, and work through that. Other than that, I don't. Maybe Ronald Williams comes in for one of the corner spots, maybe. But that's about as far as I could tell, you know, as far as I can predict, like, reasonable changes now. I don't think Jaden Mangum's ready yet to take a starting safety role, even though I think Gross had some iffy moments out there. I don't think he's ready for that yet against a Big Ten opponent. So and here's the other thing is you can sort of cover the, you know, so we're talking about the nickel position. What do you do there and all that? You can cover it up pretty good this week, I think, by just playing three linebackers. You know, Minnesota's going to come in here and want to run the ball 40-plus times. That's their identity is a ground-and-pound, you know, hard-nosed type of offense. That, obviously, they have an experienced quarterback, but they want to be a run-first team. And so maybe you just kick the can at nickel and say, we'll figure it out later and just play three linebackers, you know, and look more like the old D'Antonio defense. I could see that for sure, just given the run game, the, you know, the style and the personnel that they'll probably be seeing against Minnesota.
I thought Amir Speed had his worst game by far. You mentioned Angelo Gross. He was not effective. I thought this was a game where Xavier Henderson's experience might have helped, where he could have settled some guys down. There were just so many issues, and one of them, Stephen, was that this pass rush, and number one in the nation in sacks, really was a non-factor. And part of it was Michael Penix delivering the ball on time before receivers were even out of their breaks. But, you know, I don't know if he had to take a shower.
Right. Yeah, Jacoby Winman did not, you know, and as I said, you know, it's great what he was doing the first 2 weeks, but let's hold off anointing him, you know, as the next whatever, you know, the next Will Anderson, next this or that, you know, until he does it against some Power 5 competition. He really didn't show up in that game. I remember one time, I'm going to go back and watch more specifically with him, but I remember one time he was one-on-one with a tight end and didn't win. And, like, man, that's got to be where you make your money right there. If you're lucky enough to get a one-on-one with a tight end, you gotta make them pay for that. If he didn't win, let alone get home. So, yeah, and their pressure rate was very low. Their blitz rate was very low. I mean, I didn't really understand the defensive plan on many fronts. Ben Van Sumeren had that blitz earlier and gets called for that roughing the passer, which I thought was a little iffy, but whatever the call happened. And other than that, they never really got much heat on Penix after that. And as you said, I get it. It's hard to get to him because he does get the ball out so quick. That is a smart scheme that, you know, can anticipate and counter those types of things. But, the pass rush was lacking for sure. And so, you know, I just wrote some to our Minnesota guy who's coming on later, Ryan, like doing a Q&A. And it's like, Jacoby Winman's kind of got to prove it now, you know, against a Power 5 opponent and prove that he's not just feasting on this lower-level competition. So that didn't show up. You mentioned Henderson. I do think he would have made a difference, you know, as a communicator, as a mature set of eyes back there. Because some, you know, Mel Tucker disagreed that it was anything schematic or anything like that. He said it was mostly just mental errors, missed assignments, you know, poor technique, things like that. And, you know, X is a guy who would have ID'd some of these things. And Mel's given a few examples of, like, you know, the way they lined up on this play is a way that they never line up in practice. And for some reason, they did it in a game. Or this guy was lined up on the wrong shoulder and didn't hold his leverage downfield. And this, you know, little things. He called it rat trap. which is interesting. We've heard rat poison from Saban, and that's a different thing. But rat trap, as how he explained it, is when 2 + 2 all week equals 4. All week. It's never different. The same thing. And then for some reason, they went into the game, and 2 + 2 equals 5, 6, 1, you know, -4, whatever you can come up with. It doesn't equal equal 4, though, like they've discussed all week. And somehow, apparently, that was to blame for a lot of things that were going wrong there. So, yeah, I mean, you certainly got to turn that back on coaching. Like, how can they not, you know what they're doing in there if you practice it all week? Not saying it's just coaching or just players. It's both. But, yeah, you got to be sure that there's a mutual sort of blame there, I think.
Well, I disagree with Mel on this, and I find myself in agreement with Urban Meyer and Josh Perry on the Big Ten Network, and they broke down Michigan State's pass defense and the struggles and some of the schematic issues with that. And with the motion that Kalen DeBoer and his staff were utilizing, they had as many as 8 players flipping around, certainly 6 on a number of plays. And they wind up with a mismatch with Cal Halliday out on the flank about 5 yards from the sideline, covering a receiver, and he never saw the ball that was caught for a touchdown. So I don't know if that's what you want defensively. There's got to be another way to do this, or else more teams would be trying it.
Yeah, and I'm not a defensive guru, but I mean, even I had sort of I was watching it out there. I'm just like, what is with this plan? And it didn't seem like it ever changed. Really, that's the biggest thing. I didn't see a ton of adjustments mid-game. Maybe they were in there. They were more nuanced, I guess, than I was realizing. But I didn't think there was much change in what they were doing from start to finish. And, you know, the one thing that I kept coming back to is, at what point are you at least going to try jamming these guys at the line of scrimmage? You know, disrupting the route at its core there and throwing everything off from that end, because clearly the pass rush isn't getting home. Clearly you're not covering them well 10, 20, 30 yards downfield. So what else can you do? You can try to disrupt the timing right at the root, you know, and jam the crap out of the receivers, get them off their lines early and disrupt the timing of that route. And, you know, that'll hold Penix in the pocket. That keeps them sort of contained there, and that allows your pass rush time to get home. If you can just sort of, you know, hold steady and make life difficult for them at the line of scrimmage. That's the main thing that I was kind of calling for. But you didn't see a lot of that. You know, even when they were up, you know, they were lined up like in press, they weren't really getting physical and jamming these guys and using their length or their physicality or anything out there. They were lined up there, but then they were bailing right out and just sort of doing their, pattern matching and everything like that. So that's the big thing that I was kind of looking for. It seemed like they were just trying to, like they just dusted off the Miami game plan from last year, where it's just sit back, keep it all in front of you, sit back. The mistakes are going to come eventually. And the difference is Michael Penix isn't going to give you those mistakes the same way Derek King would have.
This secondary, Stephen, has faced 111 pass attempts. Does not have an interception yet. And last year, 4 mammoth interceptions, as bad as the secondary played, as many yards as they allowed. They don't beat Indiana without Halliday's pick six. They might not have beaten Michigan without Brantley's one-hand pick at late in the game. I don't know that they beat Nebraska without the Chester Kimbrough pick of Martinez. And then it looked like, hey, maybe Pitt was going to take the lead in that last drive in the last minute. And suddenly, Halliday gets a pick six, and it's a 10-point game. People look at it and say, well, it wasn't even a one-possession game, but it was nearly a Panthers win. So those 4 interceptions, critical to the 11-win season, and Michigan State defensive backs, I don't know if they touched the ball more than once or twice.
Yeah, I was just going to say, here's the funny thing about interceptions, Jack. You have to be close to the ball. And anybody who saw that game on TV can tell you, how many times did the Washington receiver catch the ball and the DB isn't even in the frame? Yeah, these guys, some of these plays, they weren't even close. The receivers and backs or whoever the Penix was throwing to was wide open, tight end right down the middle of the field, wide open. Nobody even within sneezing distance, you know? I mean, it was, that I think is why the frustration, that I've been hearing and feeling from fans all week and everything is sort of an overdrive, because it's like, it's one thing if Penix and his receivers are just making NFL throws on you all day and NFL plays, but these guys were running free wide open. Again, they weren't contested at the line. They were blowing right by you, you know, downfield and making easy catches all across the field. Like, I've written and said this a couple of times. I think, I don't know if Michael Penix could have come up with a better, you know, defensive game plan if he was sitting in the meeting rooms with Michigan State in terms of what he would have loved to see, because they were giving him all the throws that he know, that he loves to make and making it easy on him. I mean, he, as you said, didn't even have to shower. And just the looks, it was like 7-on-7. It was, like skeleton. I'm sorry, it wasn't even 7-on-7. There's a defense in 7-on-7. It looked like passing skeleton where the offense just throws on air, you know, a couple times because of how just far away, you know, not even close these DBs were to who they're supposed to be guarding. And that's like the troubling part for sure. Is like, man, they're not even in position to contest some of these things.
Steven, how much do you think Michigan State was bothered by the loss of Jaden Reed and Jacob Slade? I don't think they made a lot of difference in the game. I think that not having Jacob Slade against Minnesota would make a massive difference, but he wasn't going to get Michael Penix anyway. And I don't think Jaden Reed would have done that much more than Keon Coleman was able to do. He would have got a lot of those same throws. So I don't think that's the reason they lost. When did you know for sure that those two guys were not going to play? Because someone who was involved in the broadcast team told me Friday night that Jaden Reed was going to play, and he wasn't even there.
It was the morning of game day is when I knew for sure. And then when they, you know, I knew that, but, you know, I can't report everything I hear and know. But and then when they, I was down on the field, and when Jaden didn't come out for warm-ups with their specialist, I was able to confirm it, you know, through MSU and publicly report it. But, yeah, the morning of is when I heard for sure myself. And so, yeah, but I agree. I don't think either of them necessarily affected the outcome. Of course, you would like to have both. But, yeah, I, you know, as weird as it sounds, like Jaden Reed, I think, is their best player. But I don't think they really miss him a ton when you've got Jeremy Bernard and Trey Mosley, obviously Keon, but those other guys, Christian Fitzpatrick, Montori Foster came back last week and got in there. So, you know, Jaden Reed is a very good player, preseason All-American for a reason and all that, but they've got enough guys, I think, to get by there. Sort of similar defensive tackle, although Slade is their best run stopper, and he's probably just their best overall tackle there. But they weren't really getting gashed on the ground. That wasn't the difference. You know, if Jacob Slade or Jaden Reed could block inside zone or something, I'd say, yeah, you know, that affected the game. But that's not what they're asking them to do.
Someone asked me if I thought that if Michigan State had had them, you know, it would have been a much closer game. I said, maybe. If Jaden Reed could have played corner and Jacob Slade could have played on the offensive line.
Right. Yeah, exactly. So, yeah, I mean, those were two debilitating weaknesses on that day, and we'll see if they are moving forward. I've got a little more faith, I guess, that the secondary can make some steps and some strides, but the offensive line, I just don't know if they how much more room they have to grow, I guess, necessarily.
So after the first two games, we correctly said too soon to judge. Haven't played competition worthy of making any conclusions, drawing conclusions. And after last Saturday, people said, well, this game was so bad, they can't be as bad as they looked, even though the game was not nearly as close as the final score. But I'm wondering if we're going to know pretty much all we need to know about this team Saturday, and if this is as important of a September game as Michigan State has played in a long time, because it's a conference game, because of coming off the loss, and because of the schedule ahead.
I don't know about like the September thing and everything. Yeah, you know, I think some of those non-conference games, you know, during their best years, maybe, you know, like a Notre Dame win, or even going out to Oregon that year when they lost, or when Oregon came here and they won, you know, because I still don't think this is a championship team. I said that, you know, I picked them to go 8-4, and I think they're much more on that trajectory, if not a tad lower now. So. Yeah, I don't think it's that, but I do agree that we'll learn. We'll pretty much have a lot of answers, you know, after this one. So you go out there, you face a very good, high-level passing game and see what you're all about in that department. Now you're going to come back and face a very physical, you know, smash-mouth run team. You're going to see how you hold up there, and just about all the all the different kinds of tests and avenues and everything should be explored and tested by this point. We'll have a real good idea. So, you know, and if some of these things turn up 2 weeks in a row, then it's troubling. You know, I'm not completely writing off any of these units yet. I mean, you know, they could come back and rush for 120 or something this week, I guess, feasibly, or they could, you know, have a nice bounce back in the secondary. But we got to see it. You know, there's no reason for optimism until we actually see something and they prove something to us. So that's where I'm at there. But yeah, the contrasting styles, you know, we'll have seen a lot of different stuff and how Michigan State, you know, reacts to each of them, you know, by the end of the month here.
Well, the secondary won't get shredded the same way it was last week because that's not Minnesota's offense, especially without Chris Ottman Bell, top receiver. But Michigan State is going to be so committed to stop the run, and it's going to have to be. It is going to require everything the Spartans can do to stop Minnesota's running game that I predict Minnesota will get at least one big play through the air, and they specialize in RPOs, and they're going to get someone to suck up. Someone's going to have a bad read. Someone's going to be wide open, and they're going to get one of those walk-in touchdowns. And that might be the difference in a game like this.
Yeah. No debates for me. They got to prove it on both fronts, you know. And right now, the faith is basically, you know, at zero with both those groups until they do something. Because that was repeated, you know. And for both groups, it wasn't just one guy. It wasn't just one moment. It was every guy out there. First quarter through fourth quarter, basically, you know, the breakdowns were happening. So we'll see. Big bounce back opportunity, you know, on the other side of the coin. They got a great opportunity to come prove us all wrong here, but they actually have to do it because, as I wrote after the game, I mean, these were the two areas coming into the year on each side, the biggest concern on each side of the ball. Can they do this? You know, can the offensive line hold up? Is the secondary going to get better? And so far, you know, the answer is not good for either.
Do you think that we will see a bounce back from Jerick Broussard? And do you think we'll see Malik Carr. Do you think we'll see Malik Carr in the game? Not that Daniel Barker hasn't played well. He certainly did again last week. But do you think that Malik Carr, there's going to be a sighting?
I would think so. I don't know if he didn't play at all or just played sparingly out there. But I was down there on the field. Okay, I was down there on the field, and Malik was like one of the five first players out there on the field for Michigan State. Did a full warm-up thing, was catching balls from Peyton Thorne. And, you know, like you said with Jaden, they're not going to bring him if he wasn't able for some reason. So I don't know exactly.
Got a lot of
happened.
Tyler Hunt out there with Barker.
Yeah, exactly. And they did do a lot of two tight ends on the field at once. So I would think that if he's ready, then that he'll be out there. I think they should, you know, involve him more and target him more, and just especially if you can't run the ball the way you like, you just got to overwhelm people with your skill talent, which I think they can do with Keon, and you put Barker out there with him and Carr and Jaden Reed when he comes back and all that. I mean, just try to overwhelm them with your talent at the skill positions and see where that gets you, I guess. I forget what else you said. Jerick Broussard, I mean, you'd certainly hope to see a bounce back from him. You know, he's still firmly in that top group for them. I don't think you take him, demote his role really off just that game. But, hopefully he's a little more sharper, I guess, is the best way to put it for this game.
How many carries do you think we might get for Elijah Collins in this game?
I have no idea. I mean, five or less.
Or could he get some of Broussard's action?
Maybe, but I wouldn't think so necessarily. I mean, he didn't get in there until the very, very, you know, as much as Broussard was sort of not sharp out there, you know, he still stayed in the game until the very late stages when Elijah got in there. So I'd say five or less.
Yeah. I'm wondering because he has experience in Big Ten play and Broussard does not. It might be a time to ease him in a little bit. Not sure about that. As you look at this game and what is ahead, Stephen, this opportunity for Michigan State to make everyone say, well, Washington, you can just throw that out, or for everyone to get closer to the ledge here and wonder if this is a start of a six-game losing streak. If things do not go well Saturday, how do you think the fan base will react, And how do you think this team will respond?
I think everybody, if they lose, I think that everybody, or I'm sorry, if they win, I think everybody should go bet money on Washington to win the Pac-12, because they must be really good. Because I think Minnesota's pretty good, you know. I think I picked them to win the West, and I think they probably got the inside track right now. So if they're able to win this game, then hey, maybe, yeah, maybe it wasn't the disaster we're making it out to be. I mean, it was, but maybe it's not the long-term ramifications, you know, that maybe we're forecasting based off that. But yeah, if they don't win it, I mean, look, it's not an East opponent. There's still, you know, there's still things out there for them, but you just don't want to go into October feeling bad about yourself, because I think there's going to be enough in October that's going to make you feel bad. You know, you don't want to go in there with your head hung. You want to come in there with some confidence and be able to give things your best shot. But right. Talking about Ohio State, Wisconsin, Michigan, that's a tough month. And you know, if you're not in the right headspace, that thing can snowball on you quick. Because I think those are two good teams and a third really solid team.
Steven, looking at Mel Tucker's performance here, and we'll get to his self-evaluation in just a minute. But he is 15-8. As Michigan State's head coach, and I think that's better than anyone could have imagined when he was hired at this point. Certainly no one, not even Mel's mom, saw 11-2 last year. But the eight losses have all been by 11 points or more. When they've lost, they've really lost. Meanwhile, every close game, Michigan State has won. So I don't know if that distorts the record. Maybe it's a little bit of fool's gold. But Michigan State has had eight significant losses where they haven't been close.
Yeah. Well, to me, you know, just being honest, I do think that speaks to good coaching, you know, on the whole. Look, there's been some bad moments in there. I just said I didn't like this defensive approach at all last week. But so you look at that, close games winning them, that speaks to coaching, and it speaks to culture, you know, that – As sick as I am of hearing keep chopping and marginal gains and this and that, I mean, if it works and you believe it, then it works. And so I think that speaks to that part of it, winning those close games. And it also speaks, you know, when you're at roughly equal talent levels, then what has to kick in? It's coaching and it's culture, those two things. So absolutely. And when they're getting blown out, what does that speak to? A mismatch of talent for the most part to me. You know, I don't think Washington, you know, they're probably one of the exceptions. I don't think they've been on a – I don't think they're on a wildly different tier talent-wise than Michigan State. In fact, I don't know if they're even more talented than Michigan State at all. So, but some of those other ones, I do think, you know, and privately, I'm sure Tucker will tell you, very privately, but like the talent level still, even though I do think they've upgraded it once again this year, it's still not where it needs to be across the board. It's still not capable of beating Ohio State or some of those other top-tier teams, and that's what we've seen. They got blown out a few times in 2020 when they're talent was that it was really in the dumpster, and then they got blown out last year at Ohio State. So Purdue and Washington would maybe be the outliers there. And, you know, Purdue, they had some caveats with the injuries and this and that, but Washington, I'm not really going to make excuses for that one. That just wasn't good.
Right, right. Yeah, as you listen to Mel talk about the caliber of the coaching in it, I think that caught a lot of people off guard. And we've had some Mel Tucker press conferences where we've left and said, what do we really have here? But that one, he handed everyone a headline, and that's what people have been talking about all week. Do you think that was an honest self-assessment, or was he trying to maybe provide some cover for his players and the coaching staff that is under question?
No, I think that was just an honest window into how he approaches this stuff. I mean, he's still a young head coach in that realm, you know. So he's still, his instincts and his worldview and everything are still sort of shaped around being a position coach or being a coordinator. I don't think that's ever really going to leave him. So yeah, he feels like personal responsibility for the pass defense because he does coach those guys every day, and you know, he's aware of everything, you know. So he knows that people are snickering with his contract and saying, "Oh, that's what $95 million gets you, huh?" And, you know, this and that, and so he's just trying to, when he's preaching accountability all the time, he's not going to duck from that too. And so I just think that, right, you know, that's how they do it at these high level programs, and especially in the NFL. like, you know, you stand up and you raise your hand and come forward when it's your time to answer for things. And I just think that is how he approaches it. He does consider himself sort of in the foxhole with these guys in that respect, because he is coaching that group. And, you know, I just don't think that sort of coordinator position group mentality really ever left him. So I thought, that's all I took. It was just a real honest window into how he reflects on it, how he feels about this all right now.
Again, joined by Stephen Brooks, 24/7 Sports Spartan Tailgate premium site. Stephen, we have a very special guest on who covers the Minnesota Golden Gophers. Do you want to do the intro on Ryan?
He is the 24/7 Sports affiliate at Minnesota, so much like I do here. Ryan and his crew do over there and do a great job of it. So if you're looking for that angle of everything this week, go to GopherIllustrator.com and check that out. And keep listening right here, I guess, because we got Ryan to break down the game for us. Thanks for joining us, Ryan.
Yeah, I appreciate you guys having me on.
So, Ryan, how good are the Gophers? We know that the teams they have played have not won a game yet, but watching them, looks like Minnesota would move the ball on a lot of teams, and defense is pretty sound. Is this the best team that P.J. Fleck has had?
I think so. Now, I say that knowing that we're going to have to see what this offense looks like without wide receiver one, Chris Ottman-Bell, who ended up having surgery today and is going to miss the rest of the season with a knee injury that he sustained late in the first half against Colorado last week. But this is a Minnesota offense that has a lot of experience. And what I mean by that is, you have Tanner Morgan as your quarterback, who is a fifth-year starting quarterback in the Big Ten. Got to love the COVID year where that allows I don't think I've ever covered or will ever cover again a fifth-year starting quarterback in the Big Ten and Tanner Morgan, who is playing at a high level right now. You have a sixth-year running back in Muhammad Ibrahim, who just in 2020 was the Big Ten running back of the year in the Big Ten, and I think he's playing at a higher level right now than he was during that season. And then along the offensive line, all three of your interior starters are sixth-year guys, so we're talking about guys who are almost able to rent a car at a very reasonable price. So you look across the board, especially offensively, there's a lot of guys in their early 20s, which I always think is a good recipe for success in the Big Ten. And then defensively, Joe Rossi's defense just continues to get off the field. I mean, Minnesota has only allowed 4 third down conversions in 3 games. Now, you mention it.
Wow.
They have played 3 terrible teams, 3 teams that really don't have a lot going on offensively. But when you are 4 of 34 on third down against a Gopher defense, I mean, there have been, in all 3 games, Minnesota's defense has not played in the fourth quarter, and it's been because the defensive coordinator, Joe Rossi, has been satisfied about what he's seen.
I have been ranking Minnesota in the top 25 all year. I started them there. I picked them to win the West, and I think you did too, Stephen. Now I have them 13th, which is as high as anyone in the country, and on my AP preseason All-America ballot, I had Mo Ibrahim first team, which drew a lot of attention. People said, well, what are you talking about? The guy didn't play last year. Well, he played enough to gain 170 yards in 3 quarters against Ohio State, so he showed me enough. But I'm wondering about Tanner Morgan and this 6th-year status, 5 years as starting quarterback. Ryan, is he setting a record in the Big Ten for the most starts by a quarterback, and could he take this somewhere that it'll never be broken?
I mean, potentially. I mean, we just saw last season for Minnesota, they had an offensive lineman by the name of Connor Olson set the number of starts in by a Big Ten offensive lineman as he started for 5 consecutive seasons. And we're going to see a lot of different records broken, I think, this year between with this additional COVID year. But I mean, what Tanner's going to probably end up doing here, and now we're going to have to see it from this Minnesota passing game because of how many blowouts there have been. Tanner Morgan hasn't had to throw the ball more than 16, 17, 18 times a game. But I would argue he's playing at a high level during that. You know, you look at his stats, and they're not incredibly impressive right now because he hasn't thrown the ball a lot. But when you're completing 72% of your passes, wow, and I like to look at average depth of target, which is how far down the field is, you know, each one of these passes. Well, on these 53 attempts, he's throwing the ball on average over 10 yards down the field. So it's not like he's checking everything down
right.
to the tight end or the running back. He's actually pushing the ball down the field pretty well. And I look at last week against Colorado, and I'll say it again. I'm well aware that Colorado might have the next head coach opening here across Power 5 football. But, yeah. I mean, his three touchdown passes last week were all 15-plus yards down the field, and they were very accurate. So it's going to be a much bigger test than what we've seen, because with Jacoby Windham and that front seven that has done a really good job for Michigan State so far of stopping the run and getting pressure, I mean, it's going to be a much bigger test for Tanner Morgan and this passing offense than what we've seen the first 3 weeks.
Steven, what questions do you have about Minnesota?
Yeah, Ryan, me and Jack have spent most of the show talking about Michigan State's two big weaknesses, and you just sort of addressed, you know, the other side of one with Michigan State's secondary and Minnesota's passing game. Michigan State didn't run the ball well at all last week, so what does a Minnesota run defense look like? That D-line, linebackers, front seven area, like who are the guys to know there and how they've been playing so far? Again, with the caveat of understanding they haven't faced the toughest competition yet.
Yeah, no doubt. And that's where, if there's two hallmarks of a Minnesota defense under their defensive coordinator, Joe Rossi, it's been they do a really good job of stopping the run, which I think they've done so far through three games. And then they really do a good job of limiting explosive plays. I mean, the thing to know about Minnesota's defense, just looking back last season to 2021, is they were the number one defense in the country at limiting explosive plays. And that's where I think it is going to be one of the best tests Minnesota has all season, because, you know, whether Jaden Reed plays or not, you still have Keon Coleman, you still have Trey Mosley, you still have those athletic tight ends, and you look at that Michigan State passing offense that has five touchdowns of over 25-plus yards through the air. Now, I would tell you that Minnesota feels like the strength of their team or their strength of their defense is in their secondary. It's where they have a lot of veteran-laden guys. They have third- and fourth-year guys starting at safety who have seen a lot of football. They have a kid by the name of Terrell Smith, who I think you're going to see a lot on Keon Coleman this weekend, a 6-foot, 6-foot-1 guy who Minnesota's going to try to get a lot of size up against Coleman. But it's even interesting talking with Joe Rossi today. I mean, he knows the challenges, because Peyton Thorne, when given time, has been really good. And I think you guys know that. It's just when he gets off his spot a little bit, that's where things can get a little bit hairy, and that's what Minnesota's going to try to do. But they've obviously not faced a running back tandem like Jarek Broussard and Jalen Berger so far this year, and that's where if there are question marks about this defense, it's going to be in the front seven, where they've replaced a lot of guys from last year. Now they've stopped the run at a pretty efficient level here so far, but we'll continue to say it with the caveat of these aren't exactly good running offenses in New Mexico State, Colorado, and Western Illinois.
Brian, how much has Minnesota blitzed? Probably hasn't had to blitz a ton, but does it prefer to play a more conservative Iowa-style defense, or is it pin its ears back and go after the quarterback?
Traditionally, we see a lot more zone. Or at least that's what we saw last year. But I would say that with another caveat there, that Minnesota really does trust their corners. They have a lot of faith in guys like Justin Wally and Terrell Smith, BLC starting on the outside, guys like Michael Dixon and Ryan Stapp in the slot. And that's where you mentioned it. We haven't seen more than maybe a couple stunts and twists in some of these games. And I guess the beauty of it, if you're Joe Rock, you're dominating so many of these games and you're getting off the field on third down so frequently, you don't have to show a lot of blitz packages. But I think that's going to be the question, is can Minnesota generate pressure with four or five? I know that they were able to do it against lower level competition the last 3 weeks, but I think I feel like Michigan State's offensive line is certainly the best one they've faced to date. And that's where it's going to be. What does Joe Rossi try to do? Because I can assure you the number one thing I took away from his press conference today is they want to make Peyton Thorne uncomfortable. So how are they going to do that? Are they going to blitz? A lot of stunts and twists. What are they going to do is going to be the big question. But traditionally, they like to sit back because they want to make you drive down the field 8, 10, 12 plays. I mean, again, the Joe Rossi defense, when it's going really well, like it has been the last 15 games, I mean, it very much limits explosive plays, and they're going to want to make Michigan State drive the field in a 10 or a 12-play drive to get points.
Steven, who do you think the three best running backs are in the Big Ten?
Oh, man. I guess give me Travion Henderson, Mo Ibrahim, and I don't know about number three yet. I don't know if I'm ready to go there yet. Maybe one of the Penn State guys. I don't know. I know it's those two at the top.
Nicholas Singleton's pretty good, but you've got Braylon Allen. You got Chase Brown.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I'm always forgetting about Braylon. Yeah, Braylon Allen.
You got Mike Corum. You got a lot of great backs, or very good backs anyway, let's say, in this league. Ryan, how would you rank the top three running backs?
I think that's a great question, because I think there are a lot of good running backs in the Big Ten. I mean, one guy that I don't think probably gets enough love is Chase Brown from Illinois. I think Illinois is a team that I wouldn't be surprised at all that when it comes to the first 2 weeks of October, that Illinois ends up beating Iowa or Wisconsin. And I think Chase Brown is going to be a big part of that. Even Anthony Grant, I know that it actually hasn't gone incredibly well down there in Nebraska with Scott Frost not being employed, but Anthony Grant at Nebraska has done a really good job. Evan Hall continues to get a ton of touches for that Northwestern team.
Right.
But if I had to, I mean, I think you're going to go somewhere around, you can put four or five guys in the same tier, and I wouldn't argue with you, with Travion, Mo Ibrahim, Braylon Allen, Nicholas Singleton, and what he's doing there. But I do think that Chase Brown is definitely up there as well.
Is it possible that Ibrahim is the best and will be seen that way and will be a Big Ten running back of the year? I don't think he'll be offensive player of the year unless something happens with C.J. Stroud. But as far as the running backs go, I don't think there's anyone I would take over him.
Yeah, and it's crazy to say because we're talking about a guy that's coming off an Achilles injury. And if you're talking about running backs with Achilles injuries and you look at that over the course of the last 10, 15 years, you'd be a smart man to take bets against them. But as we've kind of seen here in the last, say, even 18 months between the NFL and college, you look at what James Robinson has done for the Jacksonville Jaguars, and I think he was their leading rusher last week. Cam Akers continues to come back with that from the Rams, and what Mo Ibrahim has done. I mean, there isn't another running back in the Big Ten that has more yards after contact than Mo. And Mo has over 600 collegiate carries, and he's averaging 5.7 yards per carry. And let me tell you, Mo Ibrahim is not the biggest guy, the most athletic guy. But what you're going to see on Saturday from him is he is the king of yards after contact, and specifically first contact, where it could be a two-yard loss. He's going to turn it into a 4 or 5-yard gain, and he's always falling forward. There are very little times during his collegiate career at Minnesota where Mo Ibrahim, it's a tackle for loss, or he can't find a way to get positive yardage out of it. And that's why Minnesota's also been so good on third down this year, is because Mo continues to move the chains. And that's where it's going to be a big test. This is a front seven for Michigan State that I believe is averaging under 3 yards a carry through three games. Yeah. This is going to be the most physical front seven Minnesota's faced. But I know that if Minnesota is going to emerge with a victory in East Lansing, a place they haven't won since 2006, it's going to be because of Mo Ibrahim.
Steven, I made this comparison the other day, and the guy laughed at me. But I said there are some similarities between Mo and Kenneth Walker III. Now, Mo is much bigger, put together differently, probably not going to have all the long runs. But in terms of yards after contact, last year, Kenneth Walker III was number one in the country in yards after contact. People remember all these runs where he went and nobody touched him. But it was the yards where he was able to break a tackle, where he was able to get the first down. And when watching 24 run, he does that every play.
I see where you're coming from. I understand the sharp reaction when you say that. Like, whoa, but yeah, from that aspect, I get it. He just seems like he's going to be a guy that's going to disappear, and then 3 years from now, he's going to be on Monday Night Football rushing for 3 touchdowns for the Patriots. I just know that. He's going to be that next guy that you don't hear from for a while, and then, oh, the Patriots elevated him 2 days before the game, and then now he scores 3 touchdowns on Monday, like a Jonas Gray type of thing almost from a few years ago. So that's what I'm thinking with him. Ryan, before we let you go, just real quick, any injury concerns or anything like that heading into this one that people should know about, and anything on special teams that's notable? We didn't really hit that. Any concerns or question marks there?
There's not a long enough segment that we have here for me to touch on special teams, which has been, for largely the last 3 years, incredibly unspecial for Minnesota. Their punter had one punt last week for 24 yards. They have absolutely nothing to give in the return game. Say that Minnesota's coverage units, whether it's kickoff or punt, have been really good for the last couple of years. So I'm not sure what the Spartans are going to be looking like in the return game, but I can assure you most of the kickoff is going to go through the end zone by the leg of Dragan Kelly, successful in gaining field position. But injury-wise, we touched on the top. I mean, what does this team look like without their undisputed leader in the passing game, Chris Ottman-Bell? Leading in targets, leading in receptions, receiving yards. I mean, he was their best receiver. Yeah. So who steps up? How many guys step up? What does the offense look like without their number one outside receiver is going to be the question. Other than that, they are pretty healthy. They lost their left guard last week after the first series, Axel Rushmeyer, but he didn't play in the rest of the game in that Colorado one, but we asked Fleck about it on Monday. He said he's fine. Sounds like he's been practicing. So other than losing their best pass catcher, they're in a pretty good spot health-wise coming into this game.
Well, I think we're going to see Chris Ottman-Bell next year in his ninth or tenth year at Minnesota. I'm not sure which. Ryan, thanks so much for joining us. Really appreciate it. Steven, great job. We will see you Saturday at Spartan Stadium.